From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1 8-hour visit to the University of Rochester Medical Center. If you could come up with $4,500 out of pocket, you could have the spa treatment, so to speak. In one day of exclusive medicine, you could have the kinds of screenings and doctor one-on-ones that would typically require half a dozen referrals and many weeks to arrange. This was a program billed as top-of-the-line medicine. In fact, a spokesperson for URMC told me last month that it was high-level service for high-level executives. It was called the Executive Health Program. Most people can't afford it, of course. Many Americans are on high-deductible insurance plans if they have health coverage at all. They're not able to fork over $4,500 in a single day. But that program is now ending. Last month, WXXI News broke the story that URMC invited big donors to get vaccinated through that Executive Health Program. That resulted in 26 well-connected people getting vaccines over a two-day clinic. URMC told us it was a mistake. And a few days later, both the CEO of URMC and the president of the university formally apologized to the community. They promised that there would be no more special vaccine access, and they committed to making sure that the values of equity and equal opportunity were upheld. But this was not just about vaccines. That was the message from the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee, which sent a letter to URMC leadership. In the letter, they wrote, quote, "These programs perpetuate a two-tiered health system where those who are wealthy and predominantly white enjoy unfettered access to health care, while most across the city and the region and countless others struggle to find access to the most basic levels of care. These programs represent the worst of who we have been, not who we claim to want to be," end quote. The medical center responded not long thereafter. URMC will close down its executive health program by the end of June and will reassign the team of workers to other parts of the medical center. CEO Mark Taubman said in a statement, quote, "Discontinuing programs that focused on a relatively small number of privileged individuals will enable us to improve access to services of exceptional quality for all patients," end quote. URMC is one of many hospitals that offer this kind of special treatment for wealthy individuals. Can it be justified? Some say yes. Our guests this hour are members of the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee, and I will welcome them now. Dr. Marjorie Shaw is a member of the Ethics Committee, associate professor in the Department of Medical Humanities and Bioethics. Marjorie, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Evan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. David Kaufman is with us, a member of the Ethics Committee, professor in the Department of Surgery, Medicine, Urology, Medical Humanities and Bioethics, and Anesthesiology and Perioperative Medicine. Dr. Kaufman, welcome.
Thank you for having me today.
Dr. Jessica Shand is with us, a member of the Ethics Committee, an associate professor in the Departments of Pediatrics and Medical Humanities and Bioethics. Dr. Shand, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. I am very grateful to be here.
And grateful to have you. And Reverend Lawrence Hargrave, a community member of the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee and an American Baptist pastor. Reverend Hargrave, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Let me ask all of you just at the outset here, a lot of what we are seeing changing started, and I'm not going to sit here and credit WXXI. I will credit, there was a whistleblower who reached out to us, sent me a note saying, I'd like you to see something. And there was a lot of, trust needed to make sure that person felt safe. There was a lot of nervousness. It turned out that was not just one person. There were a number of people who felt that way, who were uncomfortable with what happened in January with this vaccination clinic that ran for 2 days that was supposed to be for employees, and it ended up offering more than a couple dozen people who are well-connected donors vaccines. So when we look around the country, Seattle, Miami, parts of New Jersey, some other places, this has already happened in a lot of places. You saw, in fact, one of the big hospital systems in Seattle apologizing to the community and rebuked by the governor for offering special vaccine access to donors. So this is not a one-off. This is not the only community where this has happened. But I want to ask, and I'll start with Dr. Shaw, did that surprise you, Marjorie?
It did, but I will say that I doubt it surprised many people, but it did surprise me. And the reason it surprised me is because most of the people that I work with here at the university are like the whistleblower. They would be appalled that anybody would be given privileged access because of a donor relationship or because of a prior relationship with the institution that in any way set them apart from somebody else. it shouldn't surprise me because it is our history and it does exist. But I'm quite the optimist, and I believe that we are trying to be what we want to be. And so when we fall short, I'm always a little surprised, along with disappointed.
Hmm. Dr. Kaufman, did it surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me. I agree with Margie that I think most of my colleagues in the hospital would be appalled to learn about this. But I think there are structures in place, and the executive health program is one of them, that let people be blind to some of the inequities that occur. And so I think this was a good opportunity to address that structural problem.
Okay. Dr. Shand, what did you think?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I think in the large sense, the existence of this privilege did not surprise me. I think what we continue to learn every day of the pandemic really has been an unveiling of many injustices. And I also agree with Margie that the circles, both academic and community engagement, that we work so deeply in are always thinking of these issues. I think that for us, this event provided a beautiful opportunity to say, how can we partner? How can we use our history and our knowledge as ethicists, as that mortar that holds the principles of an organization together to create a more equitable future? So surprised, no. Energized for a better future, absolutely.
Reverend Hargrave, what did you think?
Well, I was not totally surprised. I mean, I knew peripherally somewhat of, that those situations did exist. My concern would be that this is an opportunity for the university to show leadership in the community by not only eliminating those disparities, but even leveraging those people who had been benefited from, that access, who are obviously people with leverage and money, to spread their leverage throughout the community and beyond.
Well, listeners, what I want to do also, to be sort of as fair as I can, is I want to open up to feedback from listeners if you want to share thoughts on, again, not just, it's really not a story of just one vaccine clinic that benefited donors of an organization. It is about equity in medicine. It is about the goals and how to sort of live those values. And, if you have thoughts to share on that, or maybe if you feel that there was a justification for an executive health program like that, feel free to call the program. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, or you can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And I would like to ask all of our guests to address a point that have been made to me by a number of listeners, and I've sort of observed conversations about these related stories in the last month. And the defense of the executive health program sounds essentially like this. Defenders of it will say, okay, most people can't afford to spend $4,500 for an 8-hour session where you get, all of these screenings and all of this one-on-one exclusive medicine. But if you get enough people who can afford that, then, they get what most people in the community can't, but that allows the organization to then leverage their dollars to help more people in different ways. Is there a defense along those lines, Dr. Shaw?
I don't think there's a defense along those lines. I mean, it's interesting. When I think about these programs, what my colleague said in answer to the previous question I think is really important, which is that this indicated that there are structural inequities that we have not undone. And so what's really important about these executive health programs is they come out of a history that is related to how we provide health care in this country, which is through our employers. And so most of these are companies who are trying to recruit executives, and they create relationships with the university for executive health programs so that they can recruit executives into their institutions. This is a bad model. And so what we can do as an institution of URMC and other healthcare institutions is we can create relationships with companies to provide care to all of their employees. And we just need to rethink how we create these relationships.
Well, interestingly, the CEO, Mark Taubman, seems to not accept the argument that defenders of executive health have made in his statement. I'm going to read again what he wrote. He wrote, quote, "Discontinuing programs that focused on a relatively small number of privileged individuals will enable us to improve access to services of exceptional quality for all patients," end quote. Dr. Shaw, that reads to me like a concession that by focusing on wealthy individuals, even if it's a small number of wealthy individuals, URMC was less able to provide access for all. And by discontinuing executive health, URMC can now provide more focus on access for all. That is certainly how the statement reads to me. Do you read it that way?
So what I understand with Dean Taubman's statements about this is that he has, in ending this program, he has expressed a commitment to making sure that we have that we do improve our access into our services to all of our patients. And that's what it is, when we talk about excitement that this is for the future and the potential, that that's actually where we need to be focusing our attention. And I read his statements to be saying that he's committed to doing that going forward.
Okay, fair enough. Dr. Kaufman, you know, what do you say to those who have supported executive health by saying, look, this is a program that afforded us more flexibility to help more people because of what we were able to bring in from it, and eliminating this program will have deleterious effects?
I think that every argument could be made for, you know, benefits and risks of programs like this in terms of the finances, potentially supporting other endeavors in the hospital. But I completely agree with Margie Shaw. I think the risks to inequities are far too great to allow a program like this to continue to exist.
Okay, and Dr. Kaufman, some of the other defenders I have just sort of observed in conversation over the last month have indicated that they feel that those who were of means to participate in the executive health program will just say, fine, I will drive to Buffalo. I will fly to New York City. I will go somewhere else. I will get essentially the same level of one-on-one high-level care from many of the other medical systems that offer the same thing. If you won't do it here, I'll take my money there, and maybe I'll take my donor dollars there, too. Is there a concern about that?
Well, not from me, and given Dr. Taubman's words, I don't think there is from him either. I think he's committed, and I think the institution's committed right now to change course and do the right thing when it comes to the executive health program.
Dr. Shan, how do you see the defense of executive health?
Yeah, so from a donor fund and a fundraising perspective, I think that in the large scheme of things, and in this important moment in the evolution of the identity of our institution and other institutions wrestling with the same question, there is always an opportunity to evolve the way we fundraise and the way we think about donor contributions and support for vital programs through an equity lens. And I don't think anyone in the institution feels that the loss of that donor that you just gave in your example, or finances that came in from executive health or special patient services, is going to substantially negatively impact where we are going and where we hope to go in terms of equitable health care access and programs. We may just need to imagine and work differently about how we approach donor fundraising, and I think that's, again, another wonderful opportunity for ethicists and those who think about health equity to be at the table and to be involved.
Yeah, and so, Dr. Shan, let me follow up. That's such an important point that you're raising here, because if everyone walks away from the story now, then maybe there isn't a whole lot of change. And I'm not saying there isn't intention to change from the leadership of the organizations involved here, but there's a lot of work to make change. When this story first broke, the first thing that we were told by URMC was, well, this is not how we do things. We're surprised that this happened. And our chief fundraising officer stepped out of line, but it was a mistake, and you know we'll deal with that because that's not how we do things. And it sort of quickly became clear that in at least in the eyes of some people in fundraising, that is how you do things, whether it should be or not. And I want to be really fair here and say that I am hardly perfect. I work in an organization that asks the community to support us. We try to draw very strict lines. For example, if an organization decides to provide underwriting for WXXI, that doesn't mean you can call the newsroom and say, come do a story on us. I used to work in commercial television news. And sometimes someone would say, well, I'll advertise for you guys. Will you do a news story on us? And, you know, you have to draw firm lines. I understand those phone calls happen. And I understand sometimes the requests happen. We try our best to really draw firm lines. No one is perfect. We can all do better here. But I guess what I'm wondering, Dr. Shand, is when you think about fundraising for your organization in the future, clearly fundraising matters. You know, you're not going to dismiss a whole fundraising staff and a team. But how do you get to a point where nobody, whether it's the chief fundraising officer or anybody else, thinks that this is how we do things? That, yes, we can say to somebody, sure, give us your name and we'll try to get you into a vaccine clinic. Or, you know, sure, you know, we'll get you an all-day clinic one-on-one that nobody else can get. How do you create a new way of thinking where that's not assumed that that's how we do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think my first answer to your question is by, again, really reimagining and leveraging our creative power to think about how we can do more community engagement around what programs need to, so it's not just about actual blank dollar amounts, but also what programs need to be funded. And once we prioritize what kinds of program, where the gaps in care are that we'd really like to address, that can drive part of how we think about our fundraising schemes. And I'm certainly no expert in advancement or fundraising. You know, but to take an example from my professional life as a pediatrician that specializes in cancer and blood disorders, a lot of donations or a lot of funding that we have for programs are from research funds, and some come from community fundraising, head shaving events in solidarity. And I bring that up because there just are many, many ways to engage community, to engage other creative sources of fundraising that I think, you know, create something new, something interdisciplinary, something imaginative. And so I think it's a culture change. It requires the right people to be at the table, and it requires that we look at how we fund, again, through an equity lens.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Hargrave, what would you say to somebody who would argue that, hey, if we can provide some perks for big money donors and clients, then we can reach even further into the community that is struggling?
Well, you know, I would say this, you know, and I will use the term quid pro quo. Mm-hmm. Does that sound familiar?
Unfortunately, it does. Yes.
It really sort of speaks to, you know, what has tended to be a view, and it's not just University of Rochester. It's a broad spread view, especially among people who have money, that, you know, I have money, so it entitles me to certain things. And, you know, we're really in a situation where, you know, people talk about this past year as being a year of reckoning for a number of things. I would put this along with that, is that we need to look at ways in which things can be made equitable across the board. I will say this, you know, I'm an American Baptist pastor. What a lot of people don't know, and I said a lot of people, including people in the university, is that the university was started in 1850 by people from my denomination.
Well,
you would think that, you know, with a religious underpinning and background, that, you know, the ethical standards would be ingrained in the ways in which the university does business. Well, what we find is that that is not the case. I think that having the opportunity to step back and take a look at the way the university does fundraising, and the university can use that to be more public in terms of its outreach for fundraising. There are people in this community who are not big donors who send money monthly to medical organizations outside of this community. So that's, you know, just another way of looking at it from my standpoint.
Well, I want to talk about what happens next here. And I'll read a little bit of feedback. First of all, Monique sends us a note saying, quote, "The business of advancement wooing money from donors is distasteful in academics, but in medicine it is mind-blowing. That a perk to potential and actual donors is access to health care when accessibility is a non-issue for people without money. As a UR PhD and a former employee of the U of R, I'm ashamed." That is from Monique. And I will also say that since WXXI broke the story about a month ago, I have heard from a number of current employees who don't feel comfortable speaking publicly and on the record, who are grateful to the whistleblower, grateful to the ethics committee, grateful for this, for the conversation started by the ethics committee and now picked up by administration and leadership, saying that there will be change. I know there's a, you know, sort of an unease sometimes with speaking publicly when it's your own organization, but we have heard a lot of sentiment like this. And so the question now is, are you comfortable that this is not just sort of a one-off? Because I'll start with you, Reverend Hargrave, but let me ask all of you about this. When you look at just, let's just take executive health. So URMC is going to wind it down by the end of June. One of the things I was told privately in an email is essentially, Evan, this is going to be wound down publicly. There won't be a web page and a landing site where you can register for this, but it will be done like a lot of other hospital systems do, which is with a wink and a nod and a private cell phone and a call me and we'll set you up and nothing will change. Reverend Hargrave, what do you think about that?
Well, we'll put it this way. I think that it's really up to the community to hold the university accountable. It really is. I mean, I appreciate what you said about there are people who will whisper to you about the inequities, but they won't say it publicly because, you know, there are risks to that, you know, and I do know of situations where people are so-called whistleblowers and, you know, wind up unemployed. One of the things about me being a community member in this committee is they can't fire me because I'm not on the payroll. But the challenge becomes it's really going to be up to the community to hold them accountable. It really is because, and you can go back, you know, we've had issues around race with the university for years and years and years, and it keeps saying we're going to do better, we're going to do better, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Sometimes, you know, the leadership changes and another person comes in. It's really going to be the community and people like you that will hold the university accountable. You know, they can say it, but let's see what that means.
Okay. Dr. Shand, are you confident and comfortable with the idea that the winding down of executive health means not that it will transfer to a different way of booking these appointments?
I don't know what will happen. I am confident in certainly in the university's commitment to that. I'm also, as Dr. Hargrave said, Reverend Hargrave said, I'm confident that both the community and those who feel strongly about this will continue to hold the university accountable for that commitment. I think what's important to me is that we don't lose sight of the big picture of what this is an example of. Because while there may be a small group of people that we're discussing that may continue to receive privileged health care, there are many people in our community without insurance, without the very most basic access to health care. And that is the inequity that we need to continue to focus our energy, our resources, and the community conversation toward in terms of holding ourselves accountable to a commitment towards equitable health care access. So I just don't want that particular issue to get lost in the larger picture of effectively addressing health inequity.
Okay. Dr. Kaufman, what do you think?
A couple of things. First, I want to point out, because I'm not sure it's clear to everybody, that the first voice after the whistleblowers are presumed to you actually came from our medical students. They were the first to send a letter to the university before the ethics committee.
No, that's an important point. I'm glad you point that out. Yes.
And with that, I think that points to the fact that there's a lot of hope for the future, because those medical students are our future physicians, number one. Number two, it is always possible. I'm not going to be naive. It is always possible that some things will happen behind the scenes. But without the structure there, and with all the practitioners I know that are good people, they will feel that they now have a voice to say, this is not right. We're not going to make phone calls to get people appointments earlier than other people. And so I think there is real hope. And I think Dr. Taubman's backing up that hope is really, really what's going to make a difference in the future.
Okay. Dr. Shaw, what do you think?
Well, I'm glad Dr. Kaufman said what he did about crediting the students. It's in addition to our students, it's our community members who have engaged in social injustice issues recently. I mean, Daniel Prude's death shook our institution and our leadership. We are paying attention to equity at this institution in ways that we never have before. I've already told you I'm the optimist in this group, but there's evidence. I mean, but there are reasons. There's evidence to support my optimism. The most important is the one that David already told you, our students, but it's also our community members. And the individuals in the ethics committee who really believed it was time for the ethics committee to take a different role. And that is a credit to, that's a credit to the pandemic, right? Like we have always, as an ethics committee, been focused on individual and interpersonal and interprofessional ethics issues. That's what we've done. But this is now raising, our role is now becoming one that focuses on institutional ethics, when we help the institution think about scarce allocation of resources. And now the institution is inviting us to join at that table. And so I am optimistic that that our leadership and our community members are dedicated to this change.
Talking to Drs. Marjorie Shaw, David Kaufman, Jessica Shand, and Reverend Lawrence Hargrave, all members of the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee and co-signers on a letter to the leadership after recent public conversations about not only special vaccine access for donors, but also the executive health program that privileged wealthy individuals. And now URMC and the University of Rochester addressing that, making changes, winding down the executive health program, professing a commitment to equity in more profound and public ways, and bringing in members of the ethics committee, ideally into the future, to help craft some of these new approaches. So after our only break of the hour, I want to address some of the feedback and questions that have come from listeners of this program, and we'll have a chance to do that with all four members of the Ethics Committee who are with us after this short break. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, some students in the Rochester City School District are back in the classroom in person, despite pushback from the Rochester Teachers Association. Parents in favor of in-person learning join us to talk about why they feel it's essential for their kids, and we'll be joined by RTA President Adam Urbanski, who will share why the RTA wants learning to remain virtual based on what teachers are concerned about. That's Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me read a couple of emails on the subject of ethics and the frustration of the community during this critical moment of vaccination during a pandemic. Darlene says, inequities as related to the COVID vaccine, high-risk clinics such as oncology, cardiology, hematology, etc., should have been provided the vaccine for their patients and their family members. These high-risk patients also contribute, and she puts contribute in quotes, lots of funds to URMC with their high-cost treatments. In addition, each URMC office has access to data, and these patient lists could have been sorted by birthday, age, and be given appointments and their household family members first. This random calling of people makes no sense to me. You have ill people, often people who are older and not computer literate, waiting by a phone that never rings. And so that's Darlene. Jillian says, is it ethical to set up a vaccine distribution system premised on technology that the older people who need the vaccine most don't often understand? So similar questions. And I will pose it to the members of the ethics committee. I mean, I know looking at equity in medicine goes far beyond the pandemic, but in this moment, you've got older members of the community saying, is this fair? Is this the right way to do this? I don't necessarily know an obvious better way, but I'm also not someone who spent a whole lot of time thinking about how to design this kind of a structure. Dr. Shaw, what do you make of those emails and the frustration people are feeling?
I want to acknowledge the frustration that people are feeling. It is a very difficult and challenging time, and the way that our government, both federal and state governments, have rolled out the vaccine distribution in our country has exacerbated this frustration. I mean, it is really, really challenging. And so one of the challenges is that the state rolls out and tells the hospital who they can vaccinate. And so those suggestions are really good suggestions, but they're not within the framework of the structure in which we're provided. And so the equity lens, I mean, it's really interesting. If we could go back and think about how, as a country, we should have distribute vaccines, it's the work that the scientists did in the national academies and CDC in terms of how they prioritized individuals. That was really good work. But the states didn't all follow the national academies work or CDC's work. And so we, New York State changed the allocation. Every state changed who was eligible based on the values of that state. And that's what we need to continue to analyze. I mean, one of the things that I think Dr. Shan mentioned earlier was about how we need data interrogation and transparency. We really need to analyze the decisions we're making and the impact of those decisions we're making so that we can make better decisions now and better decisions in the future.
Reverend Hargrave, what would you say not only to the two folks who sent us emails with similar subjects, frustration, you know, from the perspective of maybe older people who are having a hard time understanding how to get through and get a vaccine, but also just equity access. I mean, if it's premised on technology, there are people who don't have internet access at home. I mean, there are people. So how do you view the way the system is rolling out right now?
So first, I guess I have to say that I understand. First of all, I'm an older person. You know, I have access to technology. However, I know former parishioners, family and friends who do not have that sort of access, who, as has been stated, have, you know, waited by the phone, hoping for a phone call, and that has never come. You know, I will say that, you know, some of this has been driven by, you know, the way the federal government has delineated and distributed vaccines. But some of it also, you know, goes back to, you know, systems that are not equitable. You know, I know folks who actually as recently as yesterday, you know, called and asked if I knew a way that they could get vaccine. And you know, these are folks in their 80s with underlying conditions. And it really is just, we all have to do better. We all have to do better. And, you know, my hope is that as we go forward, that will happen. But, the challenge becomes, how do we make sure that people don't game the system? And, you know, that, you know, we've, you know, seen that it's happened here. But, you know, I know of, you know, folks, family and friends in Florida who, you know, are not able to get vaccines, and they've got people from outside the country and outside the state coming in. So, you know, we all have to do better. I think we go from this point, and we can look back, and hopefully this will be a sea change in the ways in which at least things like this are distributed, because, you know, the promise is we're going to have new viruses coming along. So we got to be prepared.
Dr. Shand, what do you think?
Yeah, so as Margie alluded to earlier, I always look at these questions both through an equity lens and through a research lens as a researcher. One of the things that our phenomenal medical students called for in their initial statement to administration, as Dr. Kaufman alluded, was greater accessibility and transparency of data. Who's being vaccinated? Where are they being vaccinated? How can our systems interface with state systems, interface with national systems in terms of vaccine availability? And I think that certainly doesn't answer the extremely important questions that were raised by the callers in the moment. But it underscores this opportunity that we have as ethicists, administrators, community health engagers, and data scientists to say, how can we make continued vaccine rollout work better, be more equitable, identify where the gaps are? I empathize very deeply with the folks who called in. I'm navigating this process for my parents, for whom it's been a challenge. I know that URMC is calling folks or attempting to call folks so that internet is not a requirement. But again, we know from many aspects of the pandemic, not just vaccine allocation and appointments, but telehealth, right? There's a certain premise that people will have the right kind of access to technology. That's an opportunity for us to look where the gaps are and make sure that we're intentional and informed about filling them. And I'm very optimistic in our ability to do so.
Dr. Kaufman?
I guess the one thing I would say that, as far as I know, all the individuals, and it wasn't just the 26 donors, but all the individuals that got the link that allowed them to sign up inappropriately at that particular clinic were also people that met the 1B criteria, and that was designated by the state. So as Margie said, there are some things that we can control. Are there some things that, like everybody else, we have to, as an institution, have to follow the rules. We can, as a big institution, argue against those rules. But the vaccine distribution is a very complicated system to roll out. When you think about the fact that we're rolling out around the world, and there aren't just inequities in Rochester, in Monroe County, in New York. There are inequities across the world.
All right, let me get back to listener feedback. This is Jane on the phone in Rochester. Hi, Jane.
Hi, ma'am. How are you?
Very good. Go ahead.
I think we've got two separate issues. I mean, they're combined, obviously, here, but one is people jumping the line to get the vaccine, and that's obviously unfair. But the idea of concierge medicine, people paying more for private practice for care, is not illegal, and it happens everywhere. And at least with a program like an executive care program, it's straight up above board. People get something that they're paying for, which is concierge service. And that's legal in the United States. So I don't think we should fault the university for offering that service as a benefit. And I mean, we all know health insurance started out as a benefit that employers could offer their employees so they didn't have to pay taxes on the money. They could just give them the service. But that meant that insurance was only available to people who are young enough and healthy enough to work. So healthcare has always been a benefit that people with money will pay for. So I think it's two separate issues, and we do need to do better. But the governor said it was going to take 7 weeks, 8 weeks to get everybody covered, so we're just in the time.
But do you then, Jane, think that logically this is a don't blame URMC, don't blame the hospital in Seattle, don't blame these hospitals who have concierge programs because it's legal and it's allowed. Change the system? Are you arguing for a systemic change in medicine?
Well, I think it's also true that if that system didn't exist above board, it would continue to go on. You know, people who know people with access, that's always going to be the way people know people. It's the way it is. I don't think it should be illegal. Obviously, the National Health Service would cover us for the data gathering and making sure that we had vaccine availability and whether or not people had been vaccinated. That stuff should be in our national health care database. Gee, a national health system. What a concept.
Well, I thought maybe you're going in that direction. I just got an email from a listener, Jane, named Matthew, who says, isn't this just about systems? Isn't the obvious path to equity a single-payer system? Do you agree with Matthew?
I do. And if you look at all of the single-payer systems that work in every other civilized country on the planet, the people who have money and extra availability can always buy better access to services. They may not be able to get better care, but they get better access because they can pay people to coordinate it.
Mm-hmm.
the same way people that have the internet have a better shot at getting a vaccine than people who don't have internet. Those are equity issues. We do need to deal with them. But the baseline, the basic safety net of the national health plan would be great. You still can't cherry pick who gets the vaccine first.
I always appreciate hearing from you, Jane. Thank you for calling the program.
And
I will talk to you. I will ask our guests if they want to weigh in then on some of Jane's comments or the listener, Matthew, who's talked about systems. Dr. Shaw, is equity more easily achieved in medicine? Not to say that there's a perfect ideal that we're all sort of walking towards and it's easy to get there, but is a systemic change necessary in your mind, Dr. Shaw?
I think there are systemic issues, absolutely, that need to be addressed. I mean, one of the things that's important is to acknowledge is that the individuals who were clients of the executive health program got the exact same medical care when they met with other providers that every other patient gets. What they got was convenience of scheduling and somebody walking them through the process and attention in a way that's different than we provided to all of our other patients. That's the inequity, but it wasn't the care we provided them. We provide the best medical care to all of our patients. And so one of the things that is really important about equity access is who are we as an institution? I mean, we are the home of the BPS model. I mean, when you think about the biopsychosocial approach in 21, it requires an understanding of the historical evolution and context, which includes these systems problems, and it requires good communication, interpersonal and management skills. I mean, leadership requires behaviors of compassion, empathy, sympathy, sensitivity towards patients and colleagues, research participants, community members, and oneself. And I believe our leadership is doing that work, which is systems changing, and prepared to do more of that necessary work. And so, yes, I think we need systems changing, and I think we are within our own institution trying to change our systems. I think we also need to look at the larger systems as well.
Okay. Dr. Kaufman?
I do personally believe that a single-payer system would be more equitable. And that's obviously a large political argument that I'm sure you have frequent conversations about on your show. I do think that there is a benefit to dismantling programs that structurally create inequities. That's not to say that it's not going to happen on the sly, but I do think moving in the right direction requires us to start by taking the programs that were put into place and taking them away. That's not to say that they're illegal. They're not illegal, but I don't think they should exist at academic university hospitals.
Okay. Dr. Shand.
Yeah, and I agree. I'm also of the mind, as Dr. Kaufman is, that a single-payer system would be more equitable. But again, I think that this particular issue provides us an opportunity as ethicists, as a community, and as a healthcare system to think more deeply about how the structures and policies we have in place affect those who currently don't have the options, the privileged options, the special options that we've discussed. And so, again, I look at there are fundamental principles in bioethics, my favorite of which is justice. And justice in healthcare is typically defined as a form of fairness, the fair distribution of what we have to offer in society, and requires that we look closely at the role of entitlement. So I think, again, an opportunity for us to really examine and create that three-part institutional, community, and ethics working partnership that we're so excited to move forward.
Okay, and Reverend Hargrave.
The need for a single-payer system, in terms of being aware of, where a lot of the gaps are in our system, I think we also ought to look at how healthcare is administered in this country. One of the things that we don't talk about is that, many of the larger companies are what's called self-insured. And so, they in many ways dictate the ways in which their insurance plans are administered to their employees. And, what that does is that locks out within companies people who are not at the highest levels of employment. but it also impacts everyone else because it impacts the systems.
Well, on the subject of systems, one more note from an email from a listener listening from Canada, listening in Vancouver. David says, "Hi, Evan and Megan. The subject is of great interest to me. When I moved to Canada some 25 years ago, I was struck by the ease of access to health care and the fact that the total deductions from my paycheck at Queen's University were substantially lower than they were at Cornell. Taxes were a bit higher, but nowhere near higher enough to match the health insurance deduction at Cornell. There was a two-digit deduction for supplemental health care at Queen's, but what a contrast. Access is much more equitable in Canada, of course, with its socialized health insurance system." That's from David. And just briefly, let me just kind of close a point that was raised earlier, but a listener named Jeremy says, "Evan, I'm a Medicaid beneficiary due to low income. I think there is a cost-benefit argument that would apply here. Sure, this is an ethically questionable program, the concierge health program, but what are the actual numbers? How many of these patients were there? And did this program serve as a de facto recruitment program to get these people to donate potentially millions of dollars to URMC? I think depending on those answers, the program might actually be beneficial." Dr. Shaw, is there an argument, is there a set of numbers that someone could show you and say, look, it doesn't feel great, but the overall numbers justify doing it this way?
So that's interesting. So what we need to do as an institution, so first of all, the numbers don't show that. So I think that's important to know. And second of all, I think what we need to do as an institution is be true to our values. We have just released an equity and anti-racism plan. We have just increased our commitment to underserved populations and tried to make sure that we actually provide that. We are addressing historical racism in our institutions and trying to earn back or to earn for the first time the trust of populations that we have not served well historically. We need to really attend to who we are and make sure that all of the decisions that we make as an institution, all of our business decisions, are consistent with who we are.
All right. So in our remaining time here, let me just ask maybe about 45 seconds apiece. I want to ask all four of you. Dr. Shaw, what do the next steps look like that would feel successful in really getting on a path to equity, getting past this vaccine donor clinic, getting past executive health? You know, what does success start to look like in your mind when it comes to equity?
So one of the things that we've done really well in the last couple of months is that we've reacted appropriately when inequities have been brought to our attention. What would be success is when we start moving to a proactive review of that.
Direct, simple. Okay. Dr. Kaufman, what do you think?
Yes, in all fairness, we've all talked about this with each other, and I agree completely with Margie. The reality is that success will be when it doesn't take Evan Dawson and the media to point out problems that we have, but we find them on our own and we fix them before they become newsworthy.
Dr. Shand?
Success for me in equity work means that the right people are around the table when decisions are being made, and not just around the table, but our voices in what gets prioritized and what gets done. A key milestone for URMC's anti-racism and equity plan is to assess barriers to care. So let's make sure that the right voices are in the right places of power to help make those decisions. And Ethics is very proud and excited to be a part of that.
And Reverend Hargrave.
You know, I would agree with, what's been said. I think, that Ethics really needs to be at the table at all levels of decision-making. And I think that as opposed to putting out fires afterwards.
And let me just squeeze in a last comment from a listener. Kathy says, "I totally agree with the caller who said that preferential treatment for well-connected patients happens all the time and probably always will. I actually think we are better off having that happen in the open through an executive program. If University of Rochester hadn't had that program in place, those people still would have jumped the line. We just wouldn't know about it." Dr. Shand, is there any argument that kind of carries weight with you that says this is always going to happen, we'd rather see it out in the open?
I think my answer to that is that regardless of where it happens, that doesn't preclude us from moving forward with ensuring that the right people, resources, and programs are in place to address the equities, to address the vast majority of more patients who require better healthcare access. And so for me, you know, certainly we always call for transparency, whether it's in data, whether it's in action. I don't know whether that is what the caller is alluding to is something that we're going to solve in the short term, but I don't think it has to be a condition of the work that everybody here has named as important moving forward.
30 seconds, Dr. Kaufman. Does this just push it underground when the emailer is saying this is always going to happen anyway? Keep it in the open.
I understand the argument. I don't agree with the conclusion. I think that when you have, a structure in place that legitimizes this kind of behavior, many people, young doctors, young nurses, think this is the way business is done. I think we have to change culture, and changing culture means not that we just push this underground, we do this secretly, but it allows everyone to realize that this kind of behavior is not appropriate.
I want to thank all of our guests, and they have their own expertise in medicine, in academics, in the faith community, and they are all members of the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee. Dr. Marjorie Shaw, grateful for your time. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Evan. It's been a pleasure to be able to talk about this.
And Dr. David Kaufman, thank you, sir.
It's really been a pleasure, too.
Dr. Jessica Shan, thank you.
Many humble thanks, Evan.
And Reverend Lawrence Hargrave, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us, Reverend.
Likewise. Appreciate what you do.
And our team here, Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Glad to have you with us, and we will be back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.